Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face Off. We are here in WGN Studios. We made it in, even though there's the alleged polar vortex. I think it's fake weather news, Tina, you know.
Well, you're also Canadian. You know, you're a very strong guy too, Rich. You know, you're Canadian, so you're able to deal with this better than most.
I was born in an igloo, so this is nothing for me. So jam-packed show today, Tina. We were talking to Patrick Cotter about the Danny Solis probe. We're talking to two prominent law school deans about bar passage rates and some other stuff in our legal grab bag. We've got some amazing in-studio guests talking about lots of breaking news. We had to actually cut probably 15 stories this week. But that all being said, we're very privileged to have in studio as our leadoff guest on Legal Face-Off, a candidate, one of many, for Chicago mayor. The election's in about a month. We've got Amara Enya in studio. Amara, thanks for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you for having me.
So, Amara, this is your second mayoral race. You were also in the 2015 race as well.
Yes.
You ended up leaving that race and supporting one of your adversaries now, Bob Fioretti. So what made you decide to run again?
Well, I didn't assume that I would run again after that first one, especially just given how grueling it was. But a lot of the issues that we talk about, that I talked about in that first race, about the need for a drastic change in leadership, a drastic change in direction, a vision for Chicago, it's the same issues, except things have only gotten worse over the years in many instances. So since 4 years ago, we've seen a lot of things happening with the city's finances. We've seen the whole outburst from on police accountability after the murder of Laquan McDonald back in 2015, the video being released back in 2015. And we've seen Chicago consistently losing population 3 years in a row now, with population decline leading the country in that metric. And so the issues are the same, but it's just more relevant now why we need a drastic change in leadership.
Amara, the situation that's getting a lot of news that we are covering later in our show deals with some aldermen who are in hot water. We covered the Ed Burke story, who's, you know, being looked at by the feds. News this week is that Alderman Solis has been wearing a wiretap against Ed Burke, probably because the feds are looking into, you know, him for a variety of offenses, including asking for, you know, Viagra,
massage parlors,
all sorts of alleged improprieties. What is wrong with city council, and what would you do as mayor to fix these issues?
Well, I think it's a culture that has been allowed to thrive in city council. There is essentially a culture of corruption that's institutionalized in the council, and it is everything from having many administrative functions that are in the hands of aldermen and legislative hands, which shouldn't be the case. We saw that with the workers' compensation program being with the finance committee under Burke, but we also see it even with small businesses that want to get additions or upgrades or what have you, and they have to go through an alderman, and oftentimes they feel that they're shaken down for those things to happen. So it is essentially built into the institutions, and many people were tacitly accepting of it, and now the blanket has been pulled off of it, and we're seeing many aldermen falling. Now, this is just the latest. I mean, we have the 20th Ward alderman who I think is no longer running, who was caught in a scandal. We've got many, many aldermen throughout the last several years who have been caught in different scandals, but it's just a culture that's pervasive in city
council. So what would you do to change it as mayor?
Well, one of the things is we have to, in terms of vetting the individuals that are running for office, I think one of the biggest criteria that we have to look at is aldermen who are interested in building independently, civically engaged constituents in their ward to whom they are accountable to. In many instances, you have aldermen who are not accountable to their actual residents. They're more accountable and responsive to the mayor, and we actually have to change that paradigm. And it sounds strange as someone who's running for mayor to be saying that the council should actually be stronger than it is, but that's the way the system was designed. It is supposed to be a strong council, and they're supposed to be responsive to their constituents and not beholden to the whims of the mayor. They also need to be supported. Quite frankly, I think that we don't have any kind of training mechanism or orientation for individuals who become aldermen. Many of them don't come out of government. They don't come out of the private sector. They don't understand public finance or budgets or all of those things, and yet we are tasking them with overseeing decision making for a $9 billion budget. So there has to be some orientation and even training capacity that I would implement as mayor so that they at least understand the basics of governing, which allows them to actually be much more effective as aldermen. That kind of independence, it creates more confident aldermen who don't have to resort to either relying on individuals who are in their ear or whomever is paying the most into their campaign fund and bending to those whims instead of the whims of their constituents.
So there are a lot of issues that you rattled off that we've talked about on this show, including Chicago public schools, the police scandals, as well as some other issues that you've talked about as part of your platform. In addition to the issue that we just discussed, what are the two other issues that you think are the most important ones that you would try to address as mayor?
Well, definitely the biggest would be the city's economy and the state of its finances, because that drives everything about the resources that the city has to make sure that services are effectively delivered and that there is balanced development across the city. The second issue would be with education and just structural problems that exist in CPS that have to be addressed if people are going to have access to a quality education and if families are going to opt to stay in the city. And then the third is this issue of violence, which to me is more so about investments that build strong individuals and strong communities, and not so much focus on just policing, because we often talk about violence as just a policing issue, and it's not a policing issue. It's actually our public policy failings across the board.
Speaking of violence, we were all shocked this week to learn of Jussie Smollett, who's on the show Empire, which is filmed locally. He's the victim of a hate crime, allegedly. We all heard about a rope being put around his neck and a foreign substance being thrown in his face. Terrible, you know, hate crime. He's an African-American actor. He's also come out a couple of years ago. He's a very prominent activist in the LGBT community. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, it is definitely a bad look for Chicago, and it's just a tragic situation overall. I mean, I know that there are still details that are still coming out, but anyone who is attacked, it's just a problem. And obviously, to be attacked because of your identity is a problem, because of your race, your sexual orientation is very problematic. And it calls to mind questions of vulnerability and those who do not have security in this city. He obviously is a celebrity, so he's better positioned than most. But I think about the cases that we hear about and that I've heard about, for example, with Black trans women being murdered at high rates across the city and their stories not getting told, or people of color within the LGBT community who still face discrimination and are very marginalized and their stories don't get told as often. So I see his experience and this story playing out as a way to lift up these issues and why we should all care about individuals and their safety and making sure that we're really paying attention to stop this before prevent this from becoming a thing in the city. It's really unfortunate.
So you have the backing of a few very well-known people in the Chicago community, including Kanye West and Chance the Rapper. Yeah. And you've come out and said that you're hoping that with the support of celebrities and individuals that are well-known in our community, like Chance the Rapper and Kanye West, that you will be able to draw more on the younger vote. Why do you think it is hard to get anybody to the polls, and even more so the younger folks that you're hoping to have come out and vote for you?
It's difficult because they are not seeing systems work on their behalf. They are constantly told to stay in their place, to accept things as they are, that you need to wait your turn. And yet they're seeing their schools close. They're seeing the lack of job opportunities for them when they graduate high school. They're seeing the lack of access to affordable housing or even any housing. So they are seeing the results of the current class of leadership, and it's not aligning with what they are told about. You need to wait for someone else to do some things. They're not accepting that. In many instances, people simply check out of the process. We had a report just came out, Kathy Cohen, who's a University of Chicago professor and the head of Gen Forward, that showed that a third of young people, millennials, don't even see a future in Chicago. That's very scary, because that's our tax base that will not be here because they don't see a place for themselves in the city. So when we are campaigning, our campaign has always been about expanding the electorate and reaching those people who have either been ignored in the process or overlooked because they're not the likely voters. And the celebrity endorsements do help to reach those that we wouldn't traditionally be able to reach.
Well, hopefully we'll see some of your supporters in the next month or so. The election is February 26th.
Yes.
Early voting has begun this week on Tuesday. And Amara Enya, good luck on the campaign trail. The website, if you want to learn more, is amaraenya.com. That's AmaraEnya.com. Again, good luck on the trail, and thanks for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us.
Rich Lenkoff is an insurance defense attorney with Bryce Downey & Lenkoff. Rich is consistently recognized by clients for his outstanding litigation results. In 2015, Target named him their top outside litigation attorney in the country. Rich has received a number of industry accolades, including Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 through 2018 and Leading Lawyer from 2012 through 2018, designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, including serving on the Lincoln Park High School Local School Council, the Advisory Board of Legal Prep Charter Academy, and the Board of Visitors for the Northern Illinois University College of Law. In addition to his full-time legal practice, Rich is a producer with credits, including 85, the greatest team in football history, starring former President Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka, and Renegades, a live show production at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon. In addition to co-hosting Legal Faceoff since 2013, Rich is the legal analyst for several WGN shows, including The Bill and Wendy Show and Patty Vasquez with Andrea Darlis. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional liability, business transactions, construction law, and intellectual property. For more information about Rich and Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, please visit bdlfirm.com.
All right, next on Legal Faceoff, Tina, we're very excited to have Patrick Cotter join us. Patrick is one of the most prominent white-collar defense attorneys in town. He's a former federal prosecutor. He's also a partner with Greensfelder. Patrick, welcome to Legal Faceoff.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, Viagra, sex acts, use of
massage parlors,
happy endings, an Oprah Winfrey farm, just another day in Chicago, aldermanic politics, right?
Well, it has some fun aspects to it, but at root, it's pretty typical, unfortunately.
So we learned this week that retiring alderman Danny Solis, who is an alderman in the 25th Ward here in Chicago, we now know why he was wearing a wire. We learned last couple of weeks that he was wearing a wire in the federal probe into Alderman Ed Burke. And we learned last couple days why he was wearing a wire. And it's likely that he was wearing a wire because he himself was the subject of a federal probe into various misdeeds. Tell us, as a former federal prosecutor, how that operation works. Is it common to try to get one person accused of a crime to flip on someone higher up the chain?
Sure. The basic tactic is known as going up the ladder, and it is very common in federal investigations. You begin to build a case on somebody who you believe is involved in the activity you're interested in. You often start a little bit lower in the chain because those people tend to be a little more vulnerable and less likely to be able to put up quite as big a fight. You then get evidence on them, you confront them with the evidence, and you say, if you want to make things less serious on yourself, help us get to the next level, help us go up the ladder. And that appears to be what happened with the Alderman Solis.
So it sounds like, in addition to him having provided some important information to the FBI about Alderman Burke, it also sounds like Mike Madigan's name has come up as well. Can you share a little bit more with our listeners about that angle as well?
Sure. What we've learned from the reports in the press is that Alderman Solis was the subject of a wiretap. They recorded somewhere in the vicinity of 20,000 calls with him over a number of years. And as part of that investigation, they also found out that there was a meeting that Alderman Solis arranged between some people who wanted to build a hotel in Chinatown and Speaker Madigan. And the purpose of the meeting was to suggest to the people who wanted to build the hotel in Chinatown that they hire Speaker Madigan's private law firm to represent them in their tax issues with the city and the state. And that came out in the investigation, though it should be noted the recording of that meeting apparently was made not by the government, but by one of the hotel developers on his own, and then that tape was turned over to the government.
Patrick, what does this say about the way the city council here runs in Chicago? We just had a mayoral candidate talk about you know, the corruption that's gone on very recently and including historically in the city council. There's been some discussion about decreasing the number of aldermen from 50 to 15. That's certainly one proposal. Why is it particular to Chicago, or is it particular to Chicago for aldermen to, you know, use their public office for personal gain?
Political corruption in city government is not at all unique to Chicago. New York, Los Angeles, all big cities have thousands of prosecutions over the last few years. What's different about Chicago is the aldermanic system, but I would argue it's not the aldermanic system that's the problem. The problem is the kind of power we give our aldermen. Proposals to reduce the aldermen from 50 to 15 simply concentrates all of the authority we give to the 50 in 15. Bad idea, in my opinion. What has to change, and the reason for the corruption, is that we give our aldermen an unprecedented and very unusual amount of authority over what happens in their districts. They have to okay every development. They have tremendous control over zoning and zoning variances. Other cities don't have their municipal representatives able to, on their own, wield that kind of power. And with great power goes great temptation, and with great temptation comes corruption. So that's why Chicago has a particular problem. I don't think it's because there's 50 as opposed to 15.
So where do you think this is all headed? Solis has been largely underground the past several days, which is not all that surprising. We've heard a couple of other aldermen, and well, we've got the Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan's name has come up. Where do you think this is headed, and what do you think this means for the future of our city council?
I think it's way too early to know where it's headed. I don't even think we know why Alderman Solis is cooperating. I don't think he's cooperating because they caught him going to a massage parlor or getting a blue pill. There's something far more serious that they caught him in, and we'll find that out. What will happen eventually is that we'll find out how far the Solis investigation, if you will, went, how many people are implicated. It's just, in my opinion, far too early to decide even what the investigation means, much less what it means for the city council.
Patrick, why is it so important as a former federal prosecutor? Why is it so important to get high profile convictions of people like Ed Burke or Rod Blagojevich? Why are those such prominent targets, and why is it important to publicly show that corruption among prominent defendants won't stand in Chicago?
I don't know that I agree with the premise. I don't think that prosecutors necessarily target people because they're prominent or well-known. I think you go where the evidence leads you. The reality is there's a lot of corruption in town, and people with a lot of power are the ones who sometimes engage in the corruption. Sometimes it's a governor, sometimes it's an alderman. There is a very proper role for prosecutors in bringing cases and making them known publicly so that you can deter similar activity amongst the population. But that's true of every prosecution. Every single prosecution brought by any federal prosecutor anywhere is always public. There's no such thing as secret prosecutions. When you prosecute somebody who's high profile, you don't have to go out of your way to make that public. The media takes care of that for you.
Patrick Cotter, officer of Greensfelder, former federal prosecutor, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Faceoff. Please come back.
I surely will. Thank you so much for having me.
We all know the legal world is complex and high pressured. There's no room for error. That's why judges and attorneys across Chicagoland have trusted the expert court reporters at McCorkle Litigation Services since 1948. McCorkle Litigation Services has accurately recorded every word from thousands of legal proceedings. McCorkle Litigation Services provides the legal community with peace of mind, transcribing testimony and depositions that can be used reliably by jurors, judges, and attorneys. For all of your legal support needs, contact McCorkle Litigation Services online at McCorkleLitigation.com.
Next, Tina, joining us, one in studio, one on the phone, are two of the most prominent law school deans here in Illinois. We've got in studio Dean Jennifer Rosato Perea from the DePaul University College of Law, and on the phone, Dean Harold Krent from Chicago Kent College of Law. Welcome to Legal Faceoff.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So we want to ask you about your feelings regarding the bar passage rates, both in Illinois and nationwide. We've heard some statistics lately about how those rates are decreasing. We'd like to get both of your thoughts on how that's affecting your law school and how you think that affects the legal community in general. Dean Rosetta Perea?
Yeah, well, I think that it's a call to all of us to try to think about why that's happening. It's happening nationwide. It's happening in the state. And why is it, because our students do need and want to pass the bar to get to the profession, that they are failing? And I think we don't have the answers yet, so that's why we're trying to go slow a little bit in terms of how we're going to react to it. But I know at most of our law schools, we are really doubling and tripling down on efforts to improve bar passage. So we're helping our students who are at risk. We're helping all of our students with foundation skills, and we're supporting all of our students in bar review because we got to get them across the finish line. So that's what the law schools, I think, are doing, and I think Hal's law school is doing much of the same.
Yeah, Dean Krem, please tell us about what you're doing and what your reaction is to the bar passage rates.
Yeah, just to set some dimension, in 2009, the Illinois bar examination rate was 89% passing. This current past year, it was 70% for the overall pass rate. And that takes a huge impact on your student body, because if you're close to the median in 2009, 10% of your students struggled. And if you're close to the median today, it's more on the order of 30%. And that's a huge difficulty in terms of entering the profession. It creates an obstacle. It creates funding problems for our students. And so we have to address it. But I think the key thing that Dean Jen suggested was, what accounts for this? And no one knows. It's clear that the selectivity of students since the Great Recession has gone down somewhat at law schools nationally, but not enough, according to statisticians, to make up for that significant dip in bar passage rate. So I have some theories, but the theories aren't empirically proven of why we've seen such a drop.
So there are actually some reasons in the press and publications that have talked about this phenomenon. There's some discussion about what some of those reasons may be, and I'd love to throw a few out there for you to see if, you know, what your thoughts are on it. Some say that it could be the admission standards going in. For example, admitting students that had low undergrad GPAs or maybe low LSAT scores or both. Some claim it's the age-old problem of some people just don't study hard enough for the bar, which we all have known over the years to be the case as well. And there's actually a theory that just given the demographic of today's law students, that in terms of how they are taught to learn, that they may not be as good at memorizing, and there's a lot of memorizing that goes into preparing for the bar. What do you both, how do you feel about those based on your frame of reference and what you've seen in some of the students that you may have worked with over the past few years and the ones that you were concerned about may be struggling?
Well, I choose theory three, and I'll explain briefly why. It's clear that admission standards have gone down in some schools slightly, some schools not at all, some schools more dramatically. Ours and probably DePaul's, we've put it in the slight category. And the question is, should there be such a profound difference on the bar because of that slight difference? And the answer is no. And we went back and looked at who are the students who are struggling with the bar. And oftentimes, and I'm sure the same thing is true with DePaul, it's not the student who was the last person admitted. We have students with excellent LSAT scores who struggle, excellent GPA scores who struggle. And so there is no clear correlation. There's some weak correlations. And so that's why I think that I favor the intuition that you suggested, that students are studying differently today. We know that this generation uses cell phones and tries to do five things at once. That's no surprise. And maybe that just doesn't breed the kind of intense studying skills and focus that is needed to pass the bar.
Dean, what are your thoughts on that?
I'd piggyback on that and just underscore, I think, that it's very easy to blame the lower admission standards. But as Hal said, it's not bearing out. We don't accept students that we don't think can pass the bar. And so it's not an explanation. And I think it has a disparate effect on our students of color, our diverse students who have been out for a while. And so we have to be very careful about making that the blameworthy reason. I think there is partly a mismatch between how we've taught and how our students coming in. So part of it is how do we teach better to students who have different study skills, who need to be more reflective about how they learn. And I think in terms of the studying hard enough, I think what we've observed also is our students are really stretched for financial reasons. And so they're in their second and third year, they're working really hard, maybe too hard to focus on some of the things that they need to do. But I think to underscore also what Hal said is that we're seeing the vulnerability of students all across the class. And so we really have to address those skills, those experiences, and all of that, you know, all of what they need, those that are at the top and at the bottom of the class.
And if I could just add one thing that I find to be sort of tantalizing, but it's hard to get a good grip on it. Unexplored in the literature so far has been the impact of online bar review prep. A massive transformation in the last 8 years in the percentage of students who are taking preparatory courses online. And I just think that if you're not disciplined, if you're not as focused, don't have that same kind of grit, it is very difficult to study sufficiently online as opposed to the discipline that comes from everybody taking courses in person.
Yeah, and I guess I would also add that the test has changed over time. That's another mm-hmm. factor that folks have looked at. So again, how well that online learning and other ways that we're preparing. And I think we need to also ask the basic question that Hal and I talk about sometimes is the bar exam really a test of competence
yes.
for the profession?
Yes, and what correlation is there between somebody passing the bar, the you know how well they do on the bar compared to their long-term success in the profession.
Right. Exactly. And of course, I think both of us and many people and as educators think there is a very low correlation. Obviously, there's a consumer protection idea. We want to make sure that people who graduate will not mislead any kind of clients here in Illinois. But I'm not sure that the bar does that because nowhere else in the law do you have to synthesize and memorize so much at once because you can take some time and study before you answer a question.
All right, Dean Krent, we're almost out of time. Unfortunately, we could talk about this for a long time. It's fascinating stuff, but we want to ask you about the ABA House of Delegates that voted just this week in Las Vegas. They rejected a proposed change to the bar passage standard that would have tied accreditation into requiring law schools to have a 75% bar passage rate within 2 years of graduation. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we always want to have some kind of assessment, and that's a measure, but I think it's a crude measure, and the reason why I think it's a crude measure is that bar passage rates differ across the states. Some are tougher, some are harder, and it's sort of unfair to school in a jurisdiction where it's tougher to be penalized just for that, particularly when there is such a weak correlation between passing the bar and being a competent attorney.
Dean Rosato Prayer, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree. I think that the House of Delegates appropriately said, let's pause on this. Let's not. Why are we rushing into it when so much is changing? The UBE, the declining bar pass rates. Let's take a pause. Let's study this more carefully, particularly because of the effect on our diverse students and our law schools that have a large percentage of diverse students in their body. They are at jeopardy.
All right. Well, we hate to end on a negative note. Give us some good news going on in both your law schools before we let you go.
Well, I think legal education is the best that it's ever been, and so we look forward to more applications in law schools. I think the legal profession is getting stronger, too, so bar passage will just catch up in the next year or two. I'm optimistic about that.
Dean Krent, you have the last word.
Sure. No, I agree, and I'm delighted that after a lull in applications, there's more interest. I may call it a Trump bump. I'm more interested in law because of all the news that's going on, but we're seeing increased applications, and I think with our technology tie with Illinois Institute of Technology, it's helping students see that there is a place for them in the law.
Dean Harold Krent of Chicago Kent College of Law and Dean Jennifer Rosato Perea, Dean of the DePaul University College of Law. Thank you very much for joining us on Legal Face Off, and please come back.
Thanks, we will.
Thanks.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Tina, now is arguably our favorite part of the show.
Although the interviews are awesome,
the interviews
too.
Are great. We were very privileged to have some great people. But we've got Legal Grab Bag. Seven, count them, seven of the most breaking legal stories out there. And this week, we've got a couple of excellent people in studio. We've got Tom Hush, who is host and producer for No Coast Cinema on WGN Plus. He's also a producer for the Saturday Night Special on WGN Radio and also for Dean Richard's Sunday Morning. Tom, thanks for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thanks for bringing me on.
And Alex Goodrich, who I've known for many years. He is Senior Vice President, Risk Management for ADR Systems here in Chicago. More than 20 years of experience in ADR, which is alternative dispute resolution and risk management, and all around bon vivant, good guy, knows a lot of things about a lot of topics.
That's way too much French for me, Rich.
That's right. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm glad to be the third wheel here.
All right, let's get right into it. So, where do we start? The Super Bowl is this weekend. It is the Rams against the Patriots. Once again, the Patriots, who we all...
Our favorite, Nat.
Our cheaters. We all agree are cheaters. Any Patriots fans?
Yeah, right here, man.
Oh, no. Here we go.
You guys will be glad to
know. Here we go.
I grew up in Philadelphia, and I'm an Eagles fan, so we took care of them last year.
We hate the Eagles, too.
No, he's perfect.
There's a lawsuit.
What are you doing in Chicago?
It should have been the Saints, right? We all agree that it should have been the Saints instead of the Rams because of the blown call in the NFC Championship game. Do we all watch it? Tina, did you see the play?
I caught a bit of it, yes.
So a clear no call. Yesterday, Roger Goodell, who's NFL commissioner, finally, after what, 12 days, came out and said that he's not going to invoke the rule that would allow him to overturn the play. Rule 17, much to the chagrin of many Saints fans, including one who has filed a lawsuit that was moved this week to federal court in New Orleans, alleging that they have suffered damages, and the remedy that they're seeking is, in fact, Rule 17 that you referenced, Tina, which I have it in front of me. According to Rule 17, the commissioner has the sole authority to investigate and take appropriate disciplinary and or corrective measures, blah, 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 if there's any calamity, non-participant interference, or club action. The key word being calamity.
Yeah, I was going to say, many think this is a calamity.
Tina, is this a calamity, and is the proper venue for this the court system? Or is this just another, person abusing the legal system?
I don't know. I mean, I can understand. It was a pretty egregious call, so I think... Rule 17 is definitely the way to go with this. And unfortunately, it gives Roger Goodell sole authority to make the call, right?
And he said he wasn't.
And it was a thumbs down. So it sounds like it's over.
Tom, what are your thoughts? Should this case continue, or is the issue resolved when Goodell said, listen, it's a game played on the field. played by human players, by coaches and officials. And there was a mistake made that we'll try to remedy in the future by fixing this rule. But what's done is done. We're not going to force the teams to go play again. That's nuts, according to the commissioner.
No, it's ridiculous. I mean, I was granted a soccer referee for a long time growing up. And it's just part of any game that you're going to play. The officials are not going to catch everything. They're going to make bad calls. And what they tell you is, you know, you have to go with it. I'm guessing the officials knew, like, right after. They were just like, oh, man, we really, you know, screwed up on this one. But Rule 17 is saved for something. I mean, this could be considered a calamity. The Saints fans certainly think so. But, I mean, I don't know what Rule 17 could be used for that would be appropriate. This certainly should not be in the court system.
Alex,
I really don't get it.
Great question for you, right in your wheelhouse, because you're in business of keeping cases outside the court system, offering alternatives to resolve disputes that otherwise would result in people suing each other in court. Is there an alternative way to remedy what we all agree was an egregious decision by the officials?
You know, there's some talk about, you know, whether they could have an additional challenge flag so they could challenge, you know, a cause. The problem is it's an opinion call, and how do you reverse an opinion on the case? Clearly, in this case, the guy missed the call severely. Whether it's a calamity or not, I don't know. A calamity might be a fan running on the field and tackling somebody, you know, and knocking them out of bounds. That would be something where, you know, Roger Goodell could order him to go back and replay the play or something like that. I don't think it belongs in the courts. I think it's something that progresses naturally and organically, and it's the responsibility of the commission to correct the problem.
But the thing is, in this case, I mean, if you've got it, you know, if you deal with lawsuits every day and your goal is to keep people out of court and resolve it through mediation or arbitration or whatever, in this case, however, there's only one remedy they're seeking, which is to replay the game. So it's not really something that you have different options for. It's not like they're looking for money, monetary damages. It's pretty much all or nothing. So in this case, the court system is the only way to go, according to the plaintiffs. I agree. I think generally it would be a mistake to start suing the league over no calls, because where does it end? I mean, yes, this is an egregious example, but maybe the next one is, you know, you think that someone's foot was out of bounds when the camera shows it wasn't. So it's a slippery slope. Who knows what the word calamity means? I don't think this fits, but
it's a game in a league, and the league has rules. Done.
True enough. moving on to there you go. Commissioner Martini has spoken. Moving on to the Fyre Festival documentaries that are dominating the news, dominating social media, at least this week. So we've covered the Fyre Festival story before.
We have. Tina. It's one of our favorite topics.
Yeah, just to refresh our listeners, Fyre Festival was a debacle. Many would call it a shit show. Can we say the word shit show on Legal Face Off?
Beep, beep.
I think we can. that landed its founder, Billy McFarlane, in jail. He's currently serving 6 years, although this week we learned that one of his years has been taken off, or will be taken off lightly, likely for good behavior and due to the sentencing guidelines. He's in jail now, convicted, pled guilty, actually, of wire fraud and money laundering. There have been two documentaries, as I mentioned, one on Hulu, one on Netflix, both of which I saw. Both of which I was fascinated by. But first of all, Tina, have you seen the documentaries?
I have not. But I know which one to watch, because apparently one is a lot better than the other.
Which one?
I heard Netflix was better.
The Netflix one was pretty good. You know, the Netflix one was produced by this company, Jerry Media, or mm-hmm. F Jerry Media, that arguably was complicit in this whole scam. So it's a little bit slanted.
Slight conflict of interest,
A little bit. The Hulu one had Billy McFarlane interviewed on it, although he adds literally nothing. He says almost nothing.
Doesn't he, like, plead the fifth to everything?
Yeah, he literally says, I can't comment, and stammers through a bunch of it. But ridiculous. Tom, you're obviously cinema and movie is right up your alley. You've seen them both? Yes.
Yeah, watched them both, one right after another. And I fall on the side of the Hulu one, which the critics are not with me. It's only got a 75% on Rotten Tomatoes. Netflix has about a 90. And but I like the Hulu one better.
From a legal perspective, do you think justice was done? Do you think 6 years was enough for the millions of dollars he scammed from people? Not once, but twice. I mean, the crazy thing about the film, and I didn't know this part, was that he was actually convicted for a second fraud, a second scam, while he was out on bail for the first one. While he was out on bail for the Fyre Festival, he was scamming people through this NYC VIP deal where he would promise tickets to events like the Met Gala, which you can't get tickets for, and other events that literally – it was just a scam.
Well, he needed to raise money for his legal expenses.
That's what it was. That's what it was.
I mean, that's a bold move. You scam someone, you've got legal expenses for that. So I'm like, well, let's double down. Let's scam again.
Yeah.
Let's go for it.
Was justice done in this case?
I mean, about as much justice as you can do. I mean, there's so much pain and suffering that gets shown in these documentaries. People just sleeping in tents, being forced to eat really bad food. And granted, these are the richest of the rich.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's hard to feel bad.
The rich millennials are getting cheese sandwiches.
But at the end of the day, these are American citizens. They're entitled to, you know, get what they paid for, and they didn't get it. So is 6 years enough? I don't know. I really couldn't speak to it, but I'm glad that he got something instead of just being able to walk away from it.
He's got a very punchable face. That's what impressed me the whole time. I mean, it's someone who you really want to administer some, you know, street justice to, because he's got this perma smile on his face that just drives you crazy.
He's just a jackass.
He's just a total jackass. Alex, have you seen the films?
I've not seen.
You've been holed up in the polar vortex for days. What have you been doing all week?
I've been
watching Netflix. Oh, working.
Working at home.
What are your thoughts on, I mean, I'm sure you heard of the Fyre Festival. What should be done to someone who commits this kind of financial impropriety?
I think that the 6 years is, you know, pretty decent sentence for what he did. And he not only did he hurt the folks that were going there, but I mean, what a scam. All those people they paid like $1,200 for basically a tent with a wet bed.
Yeah.
But I think it's a fair amount of time.
Here's the face. Who doesn't want to punch this guy?
Yeah.
Right?
That's why you like the Hulu one, right?
Yeah.
You got a chance to look at him.
I was infuriated. But let's move on to another documentary that's got a lot of attention. The Michael Jackson documentary that premiered at Sundance this week. Where
you were, Rich.
I just got back from Sundance.
Yes, but you unfortunately didn't have a chance to see it, huh?
I did not get a chance to see it. I was busy with our event, Monday on Main Street. That's 9 years running, the one that we put on with some other local vendors, including the Midwest International Film Festival, by the way. Brings back in the news the Michael Jackson allegations. There are two of his alleged victims who are featured in this film that's about 4 hours long, talking in detail about how they were abused sexually by Michael Jackson over the course of many years. One of them says that it went so far as there was a mock marriage ceremony between the two of them, all while they were underage. Tina, what are your thoughts on this one?
Well, you know, it's really this hit the news right after the movie was premiered, and actually during the movie, people were sharing on social media how disturbed and emotionally upset they were by the content of the movie. You know, his family came out right after the movie and said that it is a character assassination and full of lies. There's been a lot of commentary on, you know, the veracity of what was presented in the movie. When you scroll back and sort of do a timeline of, you know, the issues that came up, especially with respect to Wade Robeson, who is a choreographer, I believe, who was one of the people who was profiled in this movie. When Michael Jackson died 10 years ago now, he came out and very publicly said that he thought Michael Jackson was a pure example of goodness of humankind. He had actually testified at Michael Jackson's trial in 2005, saying that he had never been sexually abused by Michael Jackson and that he was an amazing person. But, you know, over the past few years, he's changed his tune. Some people say that it may be because he didn't get an opportunity to produce one, which is the Cirque du Soleil production of Michael Jackson. And he has also suffered a nervous breakdown in the meantime. He also apparently tried shopping around a book a couple of years ago where he was purportedly going to tell the story of how he was abused by Michael Jackson. So at least there are some folks that are saying that, you know, this guy has kind of gone off the deep end and is looking for, you know, for I guess, to make money off of this. And he also sued Michael Jackson's estate, too, with James Safechuck, who is the other guy who was depicted in the film. So it was a $1.5 billion civil suit that was dismissed a couple of years ago. So, I mean, I think it's awful. I mean, I wonder what's going to happen here, because this seems like it has all... It seems like it's a recipe for some sort of a defamation suit.
Tom, film often has the power of shining a light on things that otherwise would not get the attention. We've seen that with the R. Kelly allegations recently, sure, that we've covered on our show. But Michael Jackson was acquitted. I mean, it's important to remember that there was a criminal prosecution where a lot of resources were spent in an attempt to convict Michael Jackson, and he was acquitted. So is it appropriate now, all these years later, for this film to make these allegations? And as Tina mentioned, many of them are, you know, a little bit shaky.
I think that's the effect of pop culture, ultimately, because you could say the same thing about the OJ case. You could talk to a lot of people now that are just like, he was acquitted. He did not go to prison for the alleged murder. But people are like, oh, yeah, OJ, chop him up, chop him up. I'll be frank. I'm 25 years old. I have never really known Michael Jackson as anything other than an accused sex offender. So even though he was acquitted, even though the story has turned a lot more away from him being an actual pedophile, it's hard to divorce myself from that, because in the pop culture I grew up in, he was always, you know, he was Michael Jackson. He was taking kids to Neverland Ranch and, you know, doing whatever.
Interesting.
So it's hard to deal with that.
Alex, you have been alive longer and have known Michael Jackson, you know, in the public eye for a lot longer.
Yeah, he's an excellent dancer.
Interestingly enough, as we talk about the Super Bowl, on this day today in 1993, Michael Jackson played at halftime of the Super Bowl, and he said, "Today we stand together all around the world, joining a common purpose to remake the planet a heaven of joy and understanding and goodness. No one should have to suffer, especially our children." That was 26 years ago today. So, Alex, what do you think of this this latest round of allegations against Michael Jackson? Should we just let it go that he's been acquitted, or, you know, is it appropriate to let the alleged victims have some kind of voice?
I think they should be able to say what they're saying, but I think all of the stuff that I read about it indicated he was exonerated from everything, and he was under incredible scrutiny back then when the original trial was going through. Every time something's come up, it's just made him look cleaner and cleaner, and there's lots of powerful people involved. You know, Macaulay Culkin was one of the kids that went to his Neverland Ranch. If something was happening there, I suppose they had enough money to finance anything they wanted.
Now, we know, Tina, from covering these stories, you know, for a long time on Legal Face-Off, that, you know, sometimes victims, especially of sexual abuse, and especially, you know, when they're underage, it takes a while for them to disclose that. And the fact that maybe they haven't come forward until now doesn't mean they're not credible. We've seen this over and over again with victims of sexual abuse.
Yes, I agree with you completely, Rich. I think this is a little bit different, though, because not only, I mean, this is not a situation where he hasn't spoken at all. I mean, this is a situation where he testified. There were numerous occasions where, whether he was called to testify at a trial or just speaking on his own in a context where he was speaking freely and no one was forcing him to answer any questions, he came out and said that Michael Jackson was an incredibly important person to him, was very influential, changed his life. Those were not comments that they were unsolicited. He didn't have to make those comments.
All right, moving on to yet another story involving the film and allegations of sexual abuse. Bryan Singer has been hit with at least 5 sexual abuse complaints since 2014. He allegedly offered $100,000 to settle with one alleged rape victim. Bryan Singer is the director of Bohemian Rhapsody, the film that's nominated for an Oscar. Bryan Singer began directing the film and then was kicked off the film for some other reasons, allegedly being very difficult to work with. But Singer, through his attorney, has denied the story. This was reported in The Atlantic recently. There have been allegations before against Bryan Singer, dating back many years, that he's been involved with underage men. The Atlantic story goes into detail about these allegations. But yet another high-profile personality accused of sexual abuse. What are your thoughts, Tina? Will Bryan Singer ever work again?
He's already slated to work again.
Yeah, he is already slated to work again. And I think the question is whether or not he's going to actually work. I don't know. My guess is that there's going to be more information that's going to come out quickly about, you know, as we saw with some of the other cases like Cosby, Weinstein, you know, you name them, and we'll see. It depends on how bad it gets. I think it's a little bit too early to make that decision or to make that call.
Tom, you're a student of film, of course, NoCo Cinema, lifelong fan of films. You know Bryan Singer from, you don't know him personally, but know his films. X-Men, of course, and
Usual Suspects.
And you mentioned that he's slated to direct another film. Was that Red Sonja you're talking about, the Red Sonja remake?
Yeah, Red Sonja's on the slate for him. They have not said anything about taking him off, but who knows what conversations are being had behind the, you know, behind closed doors.
I mean, if you were a producer, would you risk hiring Bryan Singer?
Not a chance.
Is he talented enough to warrant these, you know,
he really isn't.
Risks?
I respect Bryan Singer as an artist, I suppose, but ever since these allegations started coming out, I don't know. It doesn't mean that I can't go back and watch The Usual Suspects and enjoy it for what it is. But I got to say, I feel bad for the people who have worked with him. They might not have known, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody, which despite being a film that I did not like really very much, I feel bad for Rami Malek because now it's like, oh, yeah, he might be winning, you know, Best Actor at the Oscars, a huge honor. And that's going to be tainted a little bit by the fact that he worked with Bryan Singer, not to a great extent because he was kicked off, replaced with Dexter Fletcher. He really finished the film. But I just think this is going to be something that serves as a black mark on the Bohemian Rhapsody name.
Rami Malek is the favorite right now. He just won the SAG Award. He won the Golden Globe. What are your thoughts on that? Should he win? I mean, Bradley Cooper had a lot of early momentum. I thought Bradley Cooper was great in A Star is Born. Nominated in the actor category, but not as director of A Star is Born. Who will win? Who should win best actor at the Oscars coming up?
Personally, I'm not a huge fan of this race. I guess you could give it. I think Rami Malek is going to be the one that gets it because he's the one thing about that movie.
It's
that
between
I
the
really
two of
enjoyed.
Them, though, probably right.
I mean, who's you can see Christian Bale coming from behind.
He won the. He won one of the early awards, the Golden Globe.
But I
Tina, have you seen Bohemian Rhapsody?
I have not, but I really want to. No.
Get to the movies, Tina.
It's been a busy year, Rich.
Good, Rich. Should Bryan Singer continue, or are these allegations enough to make him in the Woody Allen, Roman Polanski class?
Based on the industry standard of continuing to let people who make a lot of money for them go on, I'm saying that he probably will. Right now, it's just, he's just been accused of this. He hasn't been, but I think anybody who would agree to have him continue to work on it's taken a big risk.
Who do you think is going to win best picture of the Oscars? Black Panther just won the SAG Award for Best Ensemble. Black Panther fan, Goodrich?
Yeah, I thought it was a good movie.
Yeah.
It was really cool.
All right, let's move on to an interesting development with a law firm that announced their partner class, Tina. And there was something distinct or maybe not distinct about them.
You must be talking about Paul Weiss. So the news really broke. Originally, it broke at the beginning of December. Paul Weiss had an all-white new partner
class. Paul Weiss
class.
Is a law firm, not a person.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. For those of our listeners who may not be familiar with all of the large law firms, Paul Weiss is a prestigious large law firm in New York. And there's been a lot of social media buzz starting at the beginning of December when they announced their class, had pictures of everybody lined up. They were all white men except for one white woman, and there was nobody of color among the ranks. So there are a few very well-known legal blogs, including Above the Law, which Rich and I know well, just from having to deal with some interesting stories that appear on Above the Law about different law firms and so forth. But they ran with the story, and they actually mocked Paul Weiss's lack of diversity and all of what they claim they do in the name of diversity. Earlier this week on Sunday, 170 general counsel and corporate legal officers signed an open letter to address this issue. And it really was to, again, bring front and center the discussion about the need for diversity and inclusion among big law firms. So our listeners may be familiar with the fact that this is not the first time that this type of letter has been written by general counsels of companies to law firms. There was the very well-known call to action, which was many, many years ago at this point, probably over 15 years ago, where essentially the law departments of companies were saying to the law firms, if you don't present diverse attorneys on our files, then we will make buying decisions to choose other firms that do. So this has been all the rage. I can tell you that it's started discussions at my firm, Rich. I don't know if you've heard anything about it, but a lot of folks, especially in our diversity committees and so forth, have been talking about this.
Yeah, the chairman of the firm, Brad Karp, said we have a very good track record in terms of diversity. We've always been ranked at the very, very top of every survey, but certainly not a great look. Here's the actual, photo they released, and it's
Are
a bunch
sure
of
that's not a fraternity.
Yeah, exactly. True. It's a bunch of smiling white guys and then one woman. So Alex, you work with some of the biggest law firms in the city. You see what's going on. You've got your finger on the pulse of what's going on in the local legal community. What are your thoughts on this? We all agree that diversity is important in law firms and increasingly a factor that companies use when they hire outside counsel. What are your thoughts on this story?
If you look at the there's an article in New York Times put out about this, and in reading it, the one thing that struck me is how many things are in play that are preventing them from having more diversity. This firm was one of the more diverse firms out there, but they talked about having an organic connection with the partner and the associates, and that was being more important. Additionally, the partners are required to pick someone who's going to draw in the most amount of money possible to the firm. So their perception isn't really about, is it a female, male, black, white, Hispanic? It's more about, can this person bring in the money to the firm? So when you add the complexities of the money as well as the discretion of the partners and the fact that they're connecting up with people individually, I think that makes it harder for them to diversify. They talked about how they had a lot of good female and minority associates that they let get away. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's how I see it.
Tom, what are your thoughts on this?
So I'm always someone that's curious in implicit bias. Now, on top of, I agree with what he said about, they're looking for candidates who can bring in the most amount of money, who can be a solid candidate for the firm. There very well may have been a number of candidates that they let get away to different firms. But I guess it's kind of a PR disaster because it's just not a good look. Maybe was there an implicit bias in them not wanting to hire women or people of color? I don't really know. That's just kind of conjecture. But I guess it's just not a good look for a firm in 2019 that you have an all-white class of lawyers when there's so many lawyers of color, so many lawyers that are women. It's just – these are just the facts.
All right. So turning to another story involving something we deal with all the time on Legal Face-Off. Thievery of underpants, right, Gina? What's going on with people stealing underwear?
I really hope our listeners don't think that that's what you and I do in our spare time, Rich. So last week, the Iowa Supreme Court suspended a former Iowa prosecutor who pled guilty to stealing a colleague's underpants. Benjamin Stansberry has had his law license indefinitely suspended with no possibility of having it reinstated for at least a year. He's going to have some type of an evaluation by a healthcare professional verifying that he's fit to practice law before he can start practicing again. So what happened was back in 2016, he asked one of his colleagues, who was an assistant county attorney and a woman that he supervised, whether he could stop by her house with his 3-year-old son. When he arrived, his colleague was mowing the lawn, and he asked her if he could go inside and use her restroom while she watched his son. Well, apparently when he was inside her house, instead of going to the bathroom, he went to her bedroom, went into her drawers, and removed her underwear. He also took pictures of what he took. And he apparently also went through her gym bags at work and went through the gym bag of another colleague at the office and took underwear out of those bags as well and took pictures too. So, long story short, this guy, it's just, I mean, you really can't make this stuff up. He apparently lied about whether or not he had photos on his phone. He had denied deleting the photos from his phone, but he actually had deleted them. He said that when he told folks that he hadn't stolen the underwear was because he wasn't sure where it was and whether it was in his possession. So,
when will the madness end?
This is what makes lawyers have a bad name, Rich.
Tom, ever see anyone or ever been involved in any thievery of underpants?
It sounds like a fraternity thing, yeah. Doesn't it?
Good, Rich. I know that's how we first met, wasn't it? underwear thievery?
I will say one thing that I think he ought to look into moving to Japan because they apparently have vending machines that sell women's underwear.
Undergarment vending machines.
Would have saved him a lot of headaches.
Absolutely.
What a great business idea.
All right, quick hit, Super Bowl. Who's going to win, Tina? Patriots or Rams?
I think it's going to be the Patriots.
Patriots, huh?
Yeah, again? I think so. Again,
right. Tom,
sorry.
What do you got?
Go Pats. Tom Brady's the GOAT.
How are you a Patriot? Are you from Boston?
No.
Just a bandwagoner. Just like...
No. My dad came here from the UK, and the first place he went was Boston, and there was a huge... He's Scottish, so there was a huge like Irish-Scottish community there. Fell in love with the Pats. My first jersey was a Bledsoe jersey.
Since you're a movie guy, we have to ask you best sports film of all time.
Best sports film
of all
time.
You got to have that ready.
Slapshot.
Nice. Nice call.
Yeah.
Old school.
Goodrich, favorite sports movie of all time?
It's hard to argue with Slapshot.
Okay, we're going two Slapshots. Tina?
Bull Durham.
Bull Durham.
Just to be different, it's baseball.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's
great.
I
baseball.
Like Bang the Drum Slowly, early De Niro. I like Slapshot 2, weirdly enough. Ever see Goon? Oh, yes. He's an underrated
Goon was funny.
Film.
Goon's fun.
Yeah, Liev Schreiber and what's his name?
Scott.
Yeah.
The guy from American Pie. Stifler.
Stifler.
Well, Tom Hush, again, thank you for joining us. He is a host and producer for No Coast Cinema on WGN Plus, along with a bunch of other things on WGN here. Yep. Alex Goodrich, ADR Systems, thanks for joining us. Tina Martini, enjoy the polar vortex. Stay warm.
Rich Lankoff, enjoy the polar vortex and try not to float away with all the rain this weekend.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Sam, for being absent again. We'll see you next time on Legal Face Off.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat.